So earlier this year, February was such a different world. I was talking with some friends of mine and we were talking about mindfulness. And it felt like a bit of a confession because I just did. It's not as if we don't know how to define mindfulness or anything, but I was just saying, the more I get to know mindfulness directly, and the stronger as it matures and it shows up with more frequency in my daily life, the more mysterious it feels, the more mysterious it is, feels to me. But we know what it is. Like, we know when it's present. We may even like playing around with getting a sense of, okay, what is the heart mind like? What's the body like when mindfulness is present? But just finding the words and the imagery that speaks to the totality, the simplicity, the profundity of sati, mindfulness, awareness, and I'll use those three terms interchangeably tonight. That's challenging. And words and imagery is what we have, so I'll be sharing some reflections on what feels very mysterious at times. It feels very mysterious to me. Like I said, I'll be using sati, mindfulness, and awareness interchangeably. I know a lot of you have sat with and have even taken Venerable Anālayo's Satipatthana course. When you sit with him, you take this 9-week course, you listen to his guided meditations, you'll notice that he refers to sati as a friend. Actually, I was just on a, he's teaching a retreat right now and had the good fortune to be there. And when he talks about sati, there's a delight in his voice. He talks about her as his friend and he calls her she. And I remember the first time hearing this and being like, why are you calling Sati she? And I think I was coming from the perspective of like, perhaps caring a little too much or being overly concerned about the people who are in the room, knowing that there are people who don't necessarily identify in this male-female binary. And my concern was that they would perhaps be. And it turned off to what he was saying. So we have a practice meeting and we're walking outside and I'm like, why are you calling Sati she? What's up with that? And he was so patient with me. He just looked at me and said, yeah, I'm not saying that Sati is female at all. And he said that humans have archetypal energies, including archetypal energies of masculinity and femininity, no matter what our gender identification may be. And he said to him, archetypally, Sati felt feminine in quality. That Sati, mindfulness, awareness is receptive, soft. Just allow yourself to just really hear these qualities and take them in, receptive, soft, open, attentive, alert. He went on to say that sati takes in experience and gives birth to a new perspective that's potentially liberative. So that's one conception of mindfulness. There are all these different conceptions of mindfulness, right? Another conception of mindfulness is that sati is quite active, forceful, that it plunges into objects and it has a very keen, inquisitive quality to it. And these different conceptions of mindfulness don't need to be in opposition to each other or in contention with each other. In fact, all of these different approaches to cultivating mindfulness, these different ideas about what mindfulness actually is, they're all valuable, especially these two that just named, this more non-interfering, monitoring, receptive, and then the more active, keen, plunging into objects. Very, very valuable. Because for over two millennia, they've supported a multiplicity of minds in moving towards liberation and moving towards freedom. So for Venerable, in his understanding of sati within the early Buddhist context, sati is this non-interfering, receptive, monitoring presence of mind. It's nimble, curious, wants to know what's happening. For Sayadaw Upandita, active, forceful quality of mind. This is what he had to say about mindfulness. Said mindfulness must be dynamic and confrontative. In retreats, I teach that mindfulness should leap forward onto the object. If we throw a cork into a stream, it simply bobs up and down on the surface, floating downstream with the current. If we throw a stone instead, it will immediately sink to the very bed of the stream. So too, mindfulness ensures that the mind will sink deeply into the object and not slip superficially past it. So for these monastic scholars, they each had very different, individual, rich, layered relationships with sati, right? And through practice, we too start to develop our own relationship to sati. So just take a moment. Feel free to close your eyes if you'd like. You can keep your eyes open too, whatever supports you in connecting to the felt sense of body. Inviting in some tranquility, some openness. Just taking some time to reflect on your own relationship to sati, awareness, mindfulness. Is there a relationship of contention or struggle in striving to be mindful or to become mindful? Is there a kind of laxness around your relationship to mindfulness, sati? It comes and it goes. What supports the arising of mindfulness for you? Is it connecting with the felt sense of the body? Do you use a word or a mantra to help it to arise in the moment? Do you use intention? As you explore in this way, an answer may not come. That's okay. We're actually not looking for answers. We're just wanting to discover our relationship to Sati. How does your heart and mind respond when Sati reappears after moments of being lost in thought, future tripping, thinking of the past? When Sati's present, what does your body feel like? What's the quality like in your own heart and mind? So taking a moment to just thank yourself for this exploration. You can feel free to continue this throughout the week to come, just playing, okay, what's my relationship to Sati? What? How does my heart and mind respond or react when Sati arises again? For the past couple of years, I've just been saying thank you when Sati mindfulness returns and just smiling. I'm lost in some thought or I'm imagining it reappears and just thank you, a little smile. And I learned this from Venerable. And I know it may sound kind of silly, right? As a culture, we have a really odd relationship with encouragement and kindness. Sometimes in our practice, we can think we're being too easy on ourselves if we're encouraging or kind in some way. But in cultivating gratitude for Sati, smiling when she returns after being lost in thought, it's a wholesome way to counter the tendency of being hard on ourselves. Okay. I didn't get it. I'm terrible at this practice. I wish I'd started when I was younger. And when we meet the recognition of the disappearance and the returning of Sati with frustration, with contraction, with upset, for me at least, it creates this very untenable, very hostile atmosphere within my own heart and mind, and then I don't want to practice. You actually see that we're working against what modern psychology calls reward-based learning. When we meet the disappearance and return of mindfulness with acceptance, relaxation, encouragement, a mindfulness is more likely to arise in the future because it's associated with kindness, with warmth, with an attitude that the heart mind feels really finds really pleasurable. It's like a wholesome form of joy. This is a passage from Ajahn Suchito from a really thin little booklet called Unseating the Inner Tyrant. He says, handling the human heart is quite a job. So we need all the encouragement we can get. We all have energies and attitudes that need to mature into wisdom. But maybe there's a way of helping the heart to grow up by encouragement rather than through blaming. So rather than wincing when we notice the mind has wandered, rather than berating ourselves, can we encourage ourselves? Not only can we encourage ourselves, but can we bring in some understanding? Can we bring understanding to what's actually happening? We're still honest about what's happening. We see clearly, okay, mindfulness has like been lost, that the attention has landed on some experience other than the meditation object that we're wanting to be wholeheartedly with, say breath, sensations of the body, sounds, the condition of the heart mind, that it's landed on some thoughts of the past or the future or the present moment. And we're just not aware that these thoughts are occurring in the present moment. So we're straight up with ourselves. We're honest. We understand that. And we also come to understand something else that's really important. How we've used our attention in the past influences how we use or influences what our attention lands on in the present moment, right? So some months ago, again, this was before COVID or something. Yeah. Some months ago, I was about to head into retreat. It was about a month before the retreat. And during long retreats, I noticed that song loops, they're more like song universes for me. So my mind falls into these song universes that it finds very pleasant, very pleasurable. So as an experiment, I just wanted to play with not actually listening to music the month before the retreat. So I kept to this, except for once. Right? So it's within the month before the retreat, I'm spending time with a dear friend of mine who has fallen in love with Hamilton the musical. Right? She's talking about how innovative it is and how wonderful the cast is and how great the writing is. And as she's talking about this, it reminds me of my own favorite musical theater composers. Her name's Sarah Bareilles. So I send my friend one of Sarah's songs, but before I send it to her, I actually end up listening to the song. And I listen to the song just once, just one time. And after I sat down to sit, what's rolling through my heart and mind? The bass line of that song, right? And then I remember, like, okay, I can be with this in a really patient, kind way through encouragement. And we gently remind ourselves, yeah, I've been habitually thinking about X. In this example that I'm using, I turned my attention to one of my favorite songs. And of course, my attention was continuing to land on and be preoccupied with the song even as I sat. This is just natural. It couldn't be any other way, right? So how we use our attention in the past shapes what we pay attention to in the present moment, right? So if that's true, then how we use our attention in the present moment influences and it shapes how we'll use our attention in the future. So one of the beautiful gifts of practicing mindfulness, one of the gifts of just having space to cultivate sati, is that every time we see that the mind has wandered, We just return it to the present moment. Wanders return. And in doing that, we're just setting the conditions for mindfulness to arise with more frequency in the future. So sati occurs in a few different of the Buddha's lists and is associated with different practices. You have mindfulness as an awakening factor. We have wise mindfulness as one of the path factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. We have the sati practice helping us to cultivate mindfulness. And then we have mindfulness as one of the five spiritual faculties. Five spiritual faculties of faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. And sometimes these five faculties are thought of as divine influences in the heart mind. Isn't that beautiful? That faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom, concentration. Divine influences in the mind. And that these five divine influences, these five faculties, these Indriya, were named after a Hindu god named Indra. And some of the qualities associated with Indra are guardianship, bringer of rain and sunshine, is association of being a friend to humankind. So you can think of all five of these spiritual faculties, one of which is mindfulness, as a guardian, a protection. And you see this with sense restraint. It's so unfortunate that we call it sense restraint, because it makes it sound like it's this forceful, almost antagonistic thing, that we're like restraining our senses. But it's just mindfulness at each of the sense doors, right? And we're just aware of contact with particular objects and letting go of any mental proliferation that might occur due to that contact, sense restraint. Mindfulness as a guardian, as a protection. Mindfulness as a bringer of sunshine and rain. I love this imagery. You can think of sunshine and rain as that which is nourishing and life-giving and life-affirming. Mindfulness as a, when it's in conjunction with the six other awakening factors, leads us to, as the name suggests, awakening. That these seven factors, when they're in their full strength, developed within the context of seclusion, dispassion, cessation, letting go, that all seven can help us let go into and make the final breakthrough to Nibbana. So mindfulness as a bringer of sunshine and rain, that which is nourishing and life-giving. And mindfulness as a friend. Indra is a friend to humankind. Mindfulness, this divine faculty of the mind, as a friend that helps us mature into freedom. Yeah. And these divine influences, when developed, can lead to peace, light, liberation, enlightenment. This is the Buddha and one of his noble disciples. He says, "Venerable sir, it is said, one equipped with faculties. In what way, venerable sir, is one equipped with faculties?" And the Buddha says, here, bhikkhu, a bhikkhu develops the faculty of faith, which leads to peace, leads to enlightenment. He develops the faculty of energy, the faculty of mindfulness, the faculty of concentration, the faculty of wisdom, which leads to peace, leads to enlightenment. It is in this way, bhikkhu, that one is equipped with faculties. So not only is sati a state that arises and passes away due to conditions, it's also a faculty. Maybe not a permanent faculty. It's an innate capacity, an ability that can be strengthened through practice. And I love thinking of mindfulness as a faculty. And the Buddha, in his brilliance in recognizing that, because we don't start with nothing as we embark on this path. He's encouraging us to use the innate, raw capacities of our heart and then suggest practices to harness these capacities for freedom, for the development of compassion and wisdom. It's like, okay, there's this human heart. What's in this human heart that can lead to freedom? Yeah, energy, faith, mindfulness, wisdom, concentration, tranquility, joy, investigation of dhammas, right? All these beautiful, wholesome qualities. You're calling on these innate capacities that when we pay attention through wise attention, they grow in strength. They grow in maturity. So sati is a faculty and a state that once it's established, we can just rest into and also relax into. This is what Bhikkhu Bodhi, another monastic and scholar, has to say about sati. Says sati, I call it a bending back of the stream of awareness back upon oneself, upon one's own concrete immediate experience in order to bring clarity to that experience. And so I would say that sati is what keeps the object present before one's attention. Or we could even render sati as attentiveness, not as attention. Attention is turning the mind to the object. You could just play with this for a moment. Like noticing, turning your attention to the sensations in your hands. Then shifting your attention to sounds. Down to your feet. Then allowing your attention to just take it off the leash and let it go wherever it wishes. Just in this moment. You might be aware of seeing the warmth in your legs. This is the faculty of attention. Out of the myriad experiences that are arising in any given moment, attention selects some aspect of our experience. Yeah. So attention is turning the mind to the object. That's not mindfulness. It says, in fact, the Pali uses the word dharana sometimes to mean sati. Dharana means retaining or preserving, keeping the object in mind. So that is the function of sati. Let me read this again. He says, sati, I call it a bending back of the stream of awareness back upon oneself, upon one's own concrete immediate experience in order to bring clarity to that experience. And so I would say that sati is what keeps the object present before one's attention. Or we could even render sati as attentiveness, not as attention. Intention is turning the mind to the object. In fact, the Pali uses the word dharana sometimes to mean sati. Dharana means retaining or preserving, keeping the object in mind. So that is the function of sati. I really like what Bhikkhu Bodhi is saying there. That sati is not something that we do. It's not the act of turning the attention to the object. It's just this innate capacity and state that's a stream of awareness, attentiveness. It's easy to conflate the doing aspect of this practice, say the activity of attention and perception, with the state of sati. So attention, as I said, is, and as a Bhikkhu Bodhi was saying, is a function of mind that picks out aspects of our experience to be aware of. And perception is that function of mind that recognizes an experience. And sometimes that recognition is verbal, most of the time it's wordless. And it's easy to conflate the doing activity of attention and perception with mindfulness, with sati. Because what helps sati to actually grow in strength and to mature is intentionally turning our attention to our chosen meditation object, sustaining our attention on that meditation object, and from time to time, just repeatedly recognizing the object, sometimes with a gentle verbal note. This process supports the establishment of sati, but it's not the state of sati itself. And the relationship between how we use attention and perception to strengthen sati and the state of sati feels really similar to the relationship between the conditions that create a rainbow and the rainbow itself. So just imagine droplets of water in the air. The sun is behind you. Sunlight is passing through the air through these droplets of water. The sunlight refracts into seven different colors and creates a rainbow. So the water droplets, the sunlight, the motion, the refraction are the conditions that support the arising of the rainbow, but they aren't the rainbow itself. Similarly, the ways that we use attention and perception support the arising of sati, but the activity of attention and perception are not sati itself. And there's also a volitional aspect to sati too, the cultivation of sati. And there's a truth about intention that this practice has helped me to start to grok. And then one of my teachers also really made clear to me. And he talked about volition in this way. He said, our volition, intention, operates within a wider network of causes and conditions. It can influence things, but it can't control things. So, in giving ourselves to the practice of, say, satipatthana, the maturation of sati, our intention is actually one of many conditions that influences how we use attention, how we use perception to strengthen sati. But it doesn't completely control that process. And just knowing this can help us to relax around the doing aspect of this practice, the volitional aspect of this practice. We're not in control. Sati will arise due to conditions in its own time. It'll pass away due to conditions in its own time. We just very loyally tend to and just do the simple and humble work of cultivating sati with wise attention and perception, supported by or through intention, through volition. It took some time for me to recognize this. There was a time when I was confusing the experience of mindfulness with the activity that leads to the arising of mindfulness. And it would result in an imbalance of energy for me. So I'd be working with the breath and I'd be like just overdoing the turning my attention to the breath. What in Pali we call vitakka, sustaining the attention on the breath, vichara, aggressively noting the breath, this activity of perception. And I'd experience some stability. However, when I would let up on the kind of forcefulness behind attention, perception, volition, I'd get really tired. The heart wasn't feeling really inspired. The practice felt actually kind of dry and mechanical. And the stability would just fall apart. And it was as if the striving made the stability actually really fragile, because there was no food for the heart. There wasn't any kindness. I was just trying to whip myself into shape. So I'd be tired, I'd fall out of balance, I'd fall asleep, the energy would rebalance itself through sleep, I'd start the process over and over again. Don't do this. I know you all have so much experience that you probably aren't doing this. I've run the experiment, so you don't need to. What's helped me and what continues to help me to relax striving around the cultivation of sati, just being loyal to the breath or whatever meditation object I'm working with, are five things. One is just continuing to practice. Second is just weakening this striving with some kindness, with my own warmth, patience with the unfolding of practice. And just recognizing my own goodness, recognizing the goodness of the practice. And this is, for me at least, is real food for the heart. Third thing that has been a support was a poem that Andrea Fella read in a long retreat. And I still use it as every once in a while, I'll bring it in just to help undermine this striving when I notice my heart mind starting to get a little too aggressive and out of balance with cultivating sati. And I'll just work with the two first lines as an instruction. You've all heard this, no. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower. What is already present in open relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There's nothing to do or undo. Don't strain yourself. There's nothing to do or undo. Well, it's also supported me in bringing a very relaxed attitude to the cultivation of sati, especially in working with attention and perception, vitaka vichara. This is something I learned from Venerable Anālio. And what I love about it is it's an embodiment of, I just call it to mind and it helps me to relax. It's a way of working with vitaka vichara. And he said, vitaka is, I can't stand up. But I'm in this little swirly chair, so I'll do it this way. He said, vitaka is like this. So you've got your frame, you're with your meditation object. Mind shifts and you bring it back. Mm-hmm. When he did it, he was standing up and his little feet went, big feet, patter, patter, patter. And then he'd move over here, patter, 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 patter. Just coming back, vitakka, aiming the attention. Vichara. This was the gesture he used. Just touching into the object of our mindfulness. Very gentle, yeah? Like it's a ball that we're connecting with. Touching in. Gentle, kind, interested. And then a dear friend of mine who works with the Chinese agamas, she was saying that the character for vichara, so the sustaining our attention on the meditation object, is to accompany. I love that. Not wrestling the breath to the ground, not straining to pay attention to the breath, but accompanying the breath, being a companion to the breath. Getting to know it, becoming interested in it. It starts to feel comfortable, familiar, like a friend. Remember during a long retreat, after a wave of some fear had passed through me, the breath started feeling like home. Just awareness of the breath. Like being at home, just resting, relaxing into the breath. And I thought, why were you ever fearful of this? Like, this is trustworthy. So there are different ways that we can support sati in growing. The Buddha reminds us as he's talking again about the five indriya, these divine influences in the mind, again, one of which is mindfulness. This is what he says. I'm going to play with the pronouns in this. There's the case where a monk, disciple of the noble ones, is mindful, highly meticulous, remembering and able to call to mind even things that were done and said long ago. So sati has these this connotation, this association with memory and remembering. And sati in this context, it just points to the heart mind being able to remember what was said and done because sati was present. There was this knowing, attentive, open, receptive presence. That supports the recall of what actually happened. So the Buddha goes on to say, she remains focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful. They remain focused on feeling in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and mindful. He remains focused on the mind in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful. They remain focused on mental qualities in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and mindful. This is called the faculty of mindfulness. As you can hear, this is kind of a stock way that the four satipatthana are sometimes referred to in the suttas. These four areas that help us to establish and cultivate mindfulness, sati. Stronger mindfulness starts to feel in my own heart and mind. The more it arises with more frequency from day to day, it feels like I can just rest in it, that there isn't the doing. I couldn't make mindfulness sati stop being aware if I wanted to. It has that much strength. I want to share a quote with you in closing from one of my favorite authors, Toni Morrison. This is from Beloved. It reminds me so much of sati. And when you hear the word she, go ahead and substitute it for sati, mindfulness awareness. She is a friend of my mind. She gather me, man, the pieces that I am. Awareness, she gather them and give them back to me, all in the right order. It's good, you know, when you got a friend of your mind. So let's just sit for a moment or two.